Hello and welcome to Free Speech with College of the Redwoods. I'm your host, Molly Blakemore, and I'm here with my co-host.
Hello, Keith Flamer. It is a pleasure seeing you and being with you again on this interview. And also our guest today is, if you introduce yourself for us.
Certainly. I'm Ryder Deshida. I teach courses here at College of the Redwoods and at Cal Poly Humboldt. I teach U.S. history, modern and colonial Latin American history, and I also teach future middle school and high school teachers, which is to say I do history education. So I prepare students going into credential programs who want to teach social science.
So, Ryder, has being a teacher always been your goal?
No.
So talk to us about your journey.
So I originally wanted to go into the Foreign Service as a diplomat, and that's why I went to graduate school off in Washington, D.C., where I studied at Georgetown University with Global, International, and Comparative History. But when I was there in D.C. and in Georgetown, which was a really interesting experience.
Why was it interesting? Talk to us about that.
Well, I'm a California kid, born and raised, and being back east in that area, rubbing elbows with the sons and daughters of diplomats, with my t-shirts and, you know, washed out jeans with holes at the knees, it felt like I was in a GQ catalog, and I didn't really fit. So I moved back here and started teaching first at College of the Redwoods and then picked up some classes at Humboldt, and the rest, as they say, is history.
So you have been teaching this subject for how long?
Latin American history I've been teaching for about 6 or 7 years, but U.S. history since 2016 when I was first hired
so
to teach it. Yeah.
You know, I was realizing today that it hasn't been that long since the U.S. did the invasion of Latin America. Right? Mm-hmm. It's only been a month or a few weeks. And so I think that we kind of lose focus on what we did.
Yeah.
So, do you mind giving us some context around what the U.S. policy has been and how we arrived to where we are?
Absolutely. So, the United States and Latin America, as far as their history together, really goes back to when Britain first started colonizing the eastern coast of North America. And the Spanish, of course, had started colonizing the Caribbean, Mexico, Central America, and South America in the early 1500s. Yeah, you could say 1492 with Christopher Columbus, but that was a couple voyages to what is now today called Hispaniola, which is the Dominican Republic and Haiti.
Okay.
But since England started to colonize British North America, there has always been a relationship of one form or another between English-speaking people and Spanish-speaking people in the Americas and, of course, Native Americans.
Okay. So we just went in and captured the president of Venezuela.
Yes.
Under the pretext of what?
That allegedly he was involved in, I believe it was Tren de Aragua, which is a gang, a cartel in Venezuela that allegedly is smuggling drugs, namely cocaine and fentanyl, that's the allegations, into the United States. Whether or not Tren de Aragua is doing that, and whether or not it's cocaine or fentanyl, is yet to be determined.
Interesting.
But those are, yes, those are the allegations. To date, I don't think that president.
I guess he's still official president.
Yeah, president, I suppose, in captivity. Nicolas Maduro, there's yet to be any definitive proof that he is a member of any gang or cartel, except, I guess, if you count OPEC as a cartel, which it is.
Actually, it is.
Yeah. But they're not smuggling drugs, right? Mm-hmm. They are regulating oil production. Yeah, the United States went into Venezuela with Operation Absolute Resolve on January 3rd under the pretext that we were going to get this notorious drug trafficker and criminal and bring him to justice.
So what we want to do is just regime change.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of in political science circles right now, and some historian circles too. There's a lot of comparison to when the United States invaded Panama with Manuel Noriega, if you guys recall that. I think that was 1989.
Yeah,
right? 89. Yeah, so there's a lot of comparison with that, but really Manuel Noriega actually was smuggling drugs, right? Okay. And was buying or was smuggling drugs from Colombia and then moving it along into the United States.
Okay. So in terms of like geopolitical historical relationships in Latin America and the United States, would you say that this recent incursion into Venezuela fits into that same mold, or is it kind of off script for us, or is there historical context that could explain what we're doing there still now?
Yeah. Recently, and when I say recently, I'm using more political science and modern terms rather than historian terms. When historians say recently, we mean like 70 or 80 years ago.
Okay.
So I'm not talking in that way.
Okay.
So recently, for the past like 30 or so years, so really since like the Clinton administration, the United States' policy towards Latin America has been one of sort of like haphazard sanctions, where we don't like what some leaders are doing, so we're going to sanction their country's businesses in the United States, or we're going to stop giving them or selling them medicine or technology, or maybe we're going to levy maybe a trade embargo with Cuba, right? But if we dial the clock back to really the turn of the 20th century, the early 1900s, the United States was doing the sort of thing.
Monroe Doctrine, yes.
Well, that's even earlier, to the 1800s. Yes. But if you go to the 1900s, the U.S. was doing that all the time. And we should do well to understand, at least I should say as a historian, we should do well to remember that the U.S. has a long history of military interventions in Latin America, especially the Caribbean, especially Central America, and a little bit in South America. But that stopped really being a policy that the United States overtly pursued beginning in the Great Depression.
So why stop?
Well, the Great Depression. It was under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Great Depression, many U.S. businesses didn't want to invest in Latin America or protect their investments in Latin America because there was just no money to be made. And much what we saw or what we see with the Great Depression is this big contraction all around the world, where all nations that had been going out colonizing or investing in places and sending businesses around and people around, they pull them back in because they were focusing on their own internal affairs.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But to go to the Monroe Doctrine, that's the United States' first real concrete policy towards Latin America.
And this is what year, generally?
1824.
Okay. Not generally.
Specifically.
Exactly. 1824.
And curiously, it's called the Monroe Doctrine because it's attributed to then-President James Monroe, but he wasn't the guy who wrote it. It was John Quincy Adams, John Adams' son, who wrote the Monroe Doctrine.
And it said?
It said three things, and I can't quote specifically what it said, but the first
thing, generally,
it said, the United States opposes further European colonization in Latin America.
Fear of influence again.
Sort of, yeah. And this is, to give a historical context to this, 1824 is more or less the end of the period that Latin American historians call the Wars of Independence in Central and South America and the Caribbean, beginning in about 1793 with the Haitian Revolution, and then ending more or less in the mid-1820s with the Mexican War for Independence.
Okay. the first one?
Yeah, we don't say Mexican Revolution because the Mexican Revolution was begun in 1911 and lasted until 1938.
Yeah.
So the Mexican War for Independence ends roughly 1824, 26, but, you know, as historians, the dates are always a little fuzzy, so we don't really, it lasted until the late 1820s.
So ostensibly, the Monroe Doctrine was in solidarity with the independence of Latin America
from Europe. Yeah, so the first thing is they don't want further European colonization once the Spanish mainly have been driven out. The second point is the United States supports these new republics in Central and South America. And the third point, which I feel is probably the most important one, is the United States says it will protect these new fledgling republics from European influence. Now, the United States didn't have the naval capacity to actually do that, but that was really John Quincy Adams saying that through the pen of James Monroe, that the U.S. is the preeminent power in the Americas, like you said, Molly, sphere of influence. We're the, you know, the top dog, so to say. And Latin American countries, for their part, were more or less like willing to accept this because they couldn't defend themselves. So why not have the United States do it for them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so now have we just gone backwards? And so now have we just now implemented that same policy as we look at Latin America?
I think...
Maybe Canada at some point in time?
I'm not going to repeat that.
I don't blame you.
But I think that, President Trump said we're in the Monroe Doctrine, which is, of course, a play on words with Monroe Doctrine.
And Donald.
Yes,
okay.
But I don't see it that way, right? Because if it was the Monroe Doctrine really pulled from the Monroe Doctrine, the U.S. wouldn't be attacking Latin American states, right? Or wouldn't be
creating regime
change. Right. They would be protecting, like, if the Chinese or the Russians or the Turks or, I don't know, it doesn't matter, right? South Africans, whoever, came into Central or South America and the U.S. stopped that. That's Monroe Doctrine.
Oh, I see the difference.
Mm-hmm.
But did the Monroe Doctrine ever stop the United States from interfering in Latin American politics and economics and independence?
Certainly not.
Right?
Certainly not. Mm-hmm. And the United States first started getting involved in Latin American economics and politics pretty much immediately. There's the famous Mexican-American War in 1848.
Of course. Yeah.
The first time the United States ever invaded and occupied a foreign capital was Mexico City.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In 1849. And then from that point on, the U.S. was first putting economic, shall we say, colonies in the Guano Islands off the coast of Peru and Ecuador.
I've never heard of them.
Yeah. Just rocks out in the ocean that huge flocks of birds went to, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of years of piled up bird poop that they were mining.
Guano, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I did not realize that.
Big business in the 1800s. It was fertilizer, and you could use the guano also to make explosives like dynamite.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So why now? Why have we done what we've done?
Yeah.
And why Venezuela? I mean, what do you think is the real reason why we did this?
There's a lot of reasons. I have my own personal sort of conspiracy theories.
We'd love to hear them.
You got it.
Love to.
So I think that President Trump can't stand having another person in the Americas who acts the way that he wants to act.
It's the psychology of this, though.
Sort of. That and also Venezuela, of course, has huge, it's the world, as far as we know right now, has the world's largest oil reserves in the world. So that's important. And the United States also has the refineries to process Venezuelan crude oil that a lot of places in the world don't have, and there's historical reasons for that. Because
I didn't know that.
Yeah, in the early 1900s, the United States was exploring for oil in eastern Mexico and in Venezuela and in the Caribbean. And generally speaking, crude oil that comes out of Central America and South America is what is called sour crude oil. So that means sour heavy crude. So it has more particles in the oil. It also has more sulfur in the oil. So it takes longer to cook the oil into a usable product. And the United States in the early 1900s created those refineries to process that oil. Other parts of the world, like in Europe, where they got their oil from was the Arabian Peninsula, right? Saudi Arabia, Iran.
Now you're talking about OPEC again.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, OPEC is, yeah, so Saudi Arabia, Iran, we got Malaysia, and those areas tend to have what's called like lighter and sweeter oil, so it doesn't have as much sulfur, doesn't have as much stuff in it, so it doesn't take as much time to process the oil. So when it comes to who wants Venezuela's oil, it really boils down to who can process it. Mm-hmm. And it's the United States and Venezuela that can process that oil.
Mm-hmm. So things, I don't think we can say that things were going well in Venezuela up until the
Certainly
incursion.
Not.
And so can you give us a little bit of history about why that was, what was going on there?
Yeah.
Why everybody was leaving and we were seeing energy shortages.
Yeah, it's a really tragic and long history that I would say begins with Venezuela first having oil discovered by the exploratory companies. It was Jersey Standard, which was
Standard Oil,
and Royal Dutch Shell. So of course, Shell oil. Mm-hmm. And they found oil in Venezuela in Lake Maracaibo, I believe in 1917. And the Venezuelan president at the time, that was Juan Vicente Gomez, who was basically the dictator from 1908 until 1935. If you look him up, he's famous. He's supposed to have fathered something like 70 children. He used money to like build his personal highways and like rode his sports cars all over them. Well, anyways, he was, despite all that, right, his personal character flaws that
look
you can
point
out.
Look him up, it's a good story.
It's a great story. Despite all that, he was a really shrewd, like, a politician and kind of businessman, and he played these oil companies off of each other and started asking for like greater receipts or taxes on the oil, and he eventually won a concession from both Shell and Jersey Standard to get 50% of the revenue of the oil they sold.
50%?
Yeah, that's huge. And he used that, that 50-50 deal that they were eventually came to not only fill his own pockets, but also turned that around and used it to create Venezuela's like early infrastructure with roads, railroads, some small factories. And from that point in time, Venezuela's like economy and industry and, dare I say, like political society has more or less been linked with oil revenue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this gets even more... it solidified even more in the 1970s. But before I get to that, it was a Venezuelan and a Saudi Arabian that created OPEC in 1960. Hmm. And we should we should do well to remember that. Like Venezuela was one of the
principal,
the OG founders of OPEC, right? The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And it wasn't until the oil shocks of the early 1970s, after the Yom Kippur War, when oil prices shot up because the Arabian producers of oil wanted to punish the Western allies, right, that were allied with Israel by skyrocketing oil prices. When oil prices shot up, Venezuela's revenue shot up too. And the Venezuelan government realized, whoa, we can make a whole bunch of money if we nationalized oil, which they did in 1976 with the creation of Venezuelan Petroleum Limited, or as it's called, PDVSA. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, though, when they nationalized oil, they didn't like buy out the oil companies or go with a piece of paper or a law and say, you're ours now. Yeah. They just changed the name. So
explain that. What do you mean?
So you had Texaco operating there. You had you had Jersey Standard. You had Chevron, Exxon, Shell, and they just changed their. They nationalized the companies by giving them like a more Latin American, like Spanish sounding name.
Okay. Was it still a 50-50 partnership then, or was it?
Or did they take a larger percentage?
Yeah.
Good question.
Did they actually nationalize it, or was it still a partnership with all of those oil companies?
It was a partnership. And what PDVSA did was it was exploring for oil. It was, it claimed, right? It was exploring for oil. It was extracting oil. It was processing it, and it was shipping it. But really, it was just these subsidiary companies that were owned by whatever oil company they were that just had a different name. And they were the ones doing all that. Now, PDVSA did say you had to you have to hire Venezuelans to work.
But they didn't own the...
Correct.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's the way it operated until Hugo Chavez actually bought them out in 2007. And I think that's what Trump is referencing when he said they took the oil.
Right.
What he means is Hugo Chavez bought out all these companies and... they wanted back in, I guess.
And so then...
Well, some of them don't want back in.
I mean,
Exxon said there's no reason for them to go back into Venezuela because it's so expensive to do business there, so...
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so why did we do what we did
there?
Again, so what was the overall purpose in your mind if it's not oil?
Yeah. So to circle back, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
Venezuela... under Hugo Chavez and Francisco Maduro.
Okay.
And just to be clear, Hugo Chavez came into power in Venezuela in 1999, and he was there until his death in 2013.
Yeah.
And Francisco Maduro narrowly won in an election. I think he won with like 1.5% of the vote.
It was very
extremely close.
Margin,
But ever since then, he's been shifting the country to more like authoritarian government and where elections still happen, but they don't recognize. Yeah, right, sort of. You remember like Juan Guaido when he ran.
Sure.
That was 2018 or 17, if The thing I always say is when we get closer to my students, the closer we get to the present, the more the dates for me kind of get blurry. And the farther we go in the past, it's fine. But yeah, so since Hugo Chavez took over, there's been this really strong rhetoric against the United States, saying that the United States is an imperial power. It's pushing towards controlling like Venezuela and the people there, which has been a really effective political, shall I say, platform that the Venezuelans have been just really resonating with. So there's that. Like, the United States doesn't like the fact that Venezuela is saying that the United States is bad. And then there's more to do with, like, who Venezuela has been partnering with since Chavez and Maduro.
So talk about that. Who have they been?
The Chinese. Yeah. Since the early 2000s, China invested something like $64 billion in Venezuela. In loans that were actually quite favorable for the Venezuelans. As Hugo Chavez said, they were loans with no strings attached. And what he meant by that was, historically speaking, the greatest provider of money in loans and development loans to Latin America is the United States. But when the United States made these loans, either through international development banks like the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, or the World Bank, there were these conditions saying you have to have free elections. You have to have elections. You have to develop like capitalist like businesses, capitalist policies. And it was really, the IMF and the World Bank come out of the Cold War, so there's a lot of ideological stuff there. And Hugo Chavez was a self-proclaimed socialist, so he was trying to socialize Venezuelan society. So IMF, World Bank didn't want it.
So similar to Cuba.
Right, similar to Cuba.
Okay.
Which brings me to the other country that's doing business. You got China that's just giving the Venezuelans money in exchange for oil, and then you have the Cubans. And Hugo Chavez politically saw his movement, Chavismo, aligned with that of Fidel Castro. And he even said, I think at one point in time, that we are one government. And Cuba, since the early 2000s, has relied on Venezuelan oil to
exist.
So then again, what happened in Venezuela that made the oil not as profitable, and we're seeing energy shortages and people leaving, and sanctions and embargoes, or?
Yeah, so what happened in Venezuela was Hugo Chavez really oriented the country towards profiting off of oil and oil rents. So there's a lot of like economic sort of like levers and policy, really dense stuff. So if you're like an economy, like economist nerd, that's all, you know, and development nerd, fantastic. I look at that stuff and my eyes kind of glaze over. But what essentially happened was Hugo Chavez realized what we can do is we can charge companies that want to do business in Venezuela, like produce oil, rent to do it. And we will use that rent to fund social programs, education, buying medicine, building infrastructure, all that stuff. And that works so long as companies are in Venezuela producing oil and paying rent. And it's even better if oil prices are high, because then the rent is higher. And that worked well until Venezuela's economy more or less collapsed in 2013 due to U.S. sanctions. And what happened was in 2013, the United States stopped Venezuela's oil holding company in the U.S., Citgo. If you've ever, you've probably seen a Citgo gas station.
Sure.
Yeah, that's PDVSA's gas station. Mm. They own that. And they have refineries in Louisiana and Texas.
Yeah.
So since they're in the United States, the U.S. said, you can't bring oil in to refine it, and you can't sell it. And that pretty much put a stop to a lot of Venezuela's rents and revenue, which caused a huge economic collapse. I believe something like 40,000 people died between 2013 and 2018 because of a lack of medical care.
Wow.
And they were using that oil money to buy medicine. So
they were using oil money to do everything.
Yeah, and they
And also the price of oil went down because of how much we were producing, correct, too, in other parts of the world as well. So relying on those higher rents wasn't possible anymore either.
And that's a great point, Molly, because at the same time, right, in 2013, the United States emerged as one of the leading producers of oil because of shale oil and fracking.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So as I said, there's a lot going on. When you look at like oil history, there's so many moving parts.
So we created the problem in Venezuela, though, largely through sanctions.
Well, I wouldn't say we created it, but we created the conditions. I would say that Venezuela, because of its reliance on using oil profits to really fund its government and society, created the problem, which is pretty typical when you look at nations that rely on oil revenue to fund their governments. They always have this problem, including the United States, as a matter of fact. But yeah, the United States is not innocent of this, no.
Thank you for joining us for Free Speech with College of the Redwoods, and we hope that you tune in for part two of our conversation with Ryder. I'm Molly Blakemore, your host.
And I'm Keith Flamer, joining Molly.